Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. That was a delightful introduction. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, no, we were talking about Jim Carrey is just a loon, basically, right now.
And been a while since he's been a good actor.
Yeah. Well, did you see the documentary about him, about the Andy Kaufman movie? Is pretty amazing. I don't know if you've seen it.
Spooky, right? Like weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's crazy smart, too, I think. But, yeah, he's in an interesting place right now, for sure.
Yeah. And it's not Woody Point.
No, it is not. No, he is not. He is not among us here.
No, we'll get into the details on that in a bit. Now, yes, wanted to try and double dip, got greedy, tried to get you on yesterday, but we couldn't make it work. It was 30 years to the day yesterday of the Gretzky trade. Now, you are a guy. Many books have been written about Gretzky, and even now, what was it? The 20th anniversary that all the books came out, or the 25th? What was the scenario there?
There probably were. Yeah, I don't think my book was hooked to any anniversary. We weren't that smart, but it probably came out on like the 17th anniversary or something. But yeah, there's been every one time one of these things rolls around, and we are now at 30. We're going to have this, what did it all mean kind of discussion, and it's legit because it's hard. You cannot look at the National Hockey League right now without seeing the fingerprints of Bruce McNall and Peter Pocklington and everything that happened 30 years ago. That set the league on a course, and the league is still on that course. And everything did change. It fundamentally changed the NHL.
We had Marty Gelin on yesterday, of course, part of that deal. And now, what do we hear? We hear all the time, it's a business. It's not personal. It's a business. But it was totally personal then. When we were told, well, it's business. Well, how can it be business? This is personal. Oiler fans, it was not business. That was very personal for them.
Well, funny thing when people say that, right? It used to be, now it's a business. It used to be. And I don't know what X is. What, a game? Because I can tell you something. For the guys who owned the teams, it was always a business. Those guys, the Norris family, who ran teams and Conn Smythe and all, it was always a business. I'm not sure what the players thought. But it was always pretty clear in the minds of the people who owned the teams that it was about making money. And, Pocklington, Pocklington made a calculation. Now it was obviously had a lot to do with his personal finances and the various amounts of trouble he was in with his own businesses. But he made a calculation that every sports owner, like other sports owners have made, which is, what's this guy worth to me? What's this asset? This human being I have, this hockey playing asset, what's he worth? And if I could max out that value, if I can max out that value and get money for it, and it's going to get me out of troubles in other parts of my life, it's not like these guys aren't chattel. It's not like athletes aren't commodities. They are. As soon as you start paying someone to play sports, they become a commodity. As soon as you start charging for tickets, they become a commodity. It's just, what happened there for, again, a whole bunch of kind of, cultural reasons, and it had to have to do with how kind of we as Canadians have tied our identity up with one particular sport. But he just kind of threw in the face of everybody what had been true forever. But I think maybe part of what allows us to watch sport and not think of it that way, is the ability to pretend that that's not true. But you couldn't pretend when he made after that deal was made. It was pretty hard to pretend that this was, anything other than what it is.
What did you learn, either specifically about that event or about people involved in putting that book together?
Well, again, I still think the most interesting part of it. A lot of interesting parts of it. But to me, the most interesting part of it is that, you had this guy in Bruce McNall, who I still is one of the most interesting characters I've ever run into in sport, and I did some stuff about him not that long ago for Sportsnet. But, I guess we're all used to this by now, but, if you tell people you are something in a convincing enough way, if you tell a story in a convincing enough way, eventually, it's like if you dress in scrubs and walk into a hospital and act like a doctor convincingly enough, someone will let you take out someone's appendix, right? You can do that. and Bruce McNall was that guy, right? He is brilliant and charming. He created, and he did, some of the stuff was true. He was an expert in ancient coins and all of that, but he was, essentially told a story convincingly enough that people believed him and people started giving him money, including bankers, like really sophisticated financial people didn't look that closely at, you know, what his actual assets were and what they were actually worth, and started loaning him money, and then started loaning him more money to cover those loans. And then they realized, oh my God, if this thing comes down, we're coming down with him. So we're going to give him more money. So you've got this incredible pyramid based on, you know, half truths and all out, full out lies and charm. And this guy ends up in the NHL at a time when it's still, you know, really it's a mom and pop organization in a lot of ways. And manages to, you know, obviously he sees Pocklington in distress, you know, understands that, you know, if you make that deal, what's, you know, what the implications could be for his, you know, floundering hockey team in Los Angeles. But the main thing is he took over the league, you know, like every other guy in that league, every other owner looked at him and said, this guy's the smartest guy in the room. This guy's way smarter than us. So let's hand him the keys to the league. So once, you know, once that deal was made and all the movie stars started showing up in LA and, you know, the Kings were barnstorming all over the place and making money, and they looked like the, you know, kind of the epitome of a modern sports franchise. And the NHL had been forever looking up at the NFL and looking up at baseball and looking up at especially the NBA, which was, you know, in those days was the cutting edge kind of sports marketing organization. And they say, hey, we got our own guy now. Let's give him the keys and let him do what he wants with the league. You know, Bill Wirtz stepped aside as the governor of the chairman of the board of governors, so that Bruce McNall could become the chairman of the board of governors, and Bruce McNall then went out and hired Gary Bettman. You know, and he was a grifter, right? You know, he's a great guy in a lot of ways, but he's a crook.
Yeah,
and you know that set in motion, you know, the whole kind of pyramid scheme of franchise value. You know, selling those two teams in Anaheim and Florida to Disney and to what was then Blockbuster Video for $50 million each, crazy amount of money. How can you get $50 million? Of course, Bruce pocketed half of the 50 in California. and you know, if you kind of, and you know, here we are 30 years later, and it's finally, you know, the weird thing is that after all of the craziness and all of like the Boots Del Biagio's and the, you know, Jim Balsley trying to buy teams and the ongoing mess in Arizona, they found some guy in Las Vegas to give him $500 million American for a hockey team. And they're going to find somebody in Seattle to give him $650 million American. So it worked. You know, there's like a lot of bumps along the way, but you don't, you know, there's a direct line from Bruce McNall to the Las Vegas Golden Knights. There's an absolutely direct line. The league's tried to kind of, you know, erase him from history because mm-hmm. it's been embarrassing. But that's what really happened. You know, it wasn't so much, you know, about our Canadian birthright being sold. Wayne wanted to go to L.A. You know, he wanted to be there.
Yeah.
That's where his life was. He had no problem with that deal at all, you know, tears aside. But what it really did was it, you know, I guess it made us less naive, maybe. We as Canadian hockey fans, made people less naive. But what it really did was set the NHL on a course. And, you know, if you look around that league right now, including the commissioner, it all starts with that trade.
Now, refresh my memory as far as 2018 Bruce McNall. Where is he and what is his status right now?
Well, he's it's always a little vague with Bruce. He's working out of a kind of an office in Santa Monica for a guy helping him do deals. I should, you know, you can see the air quotation marks here.
I see them from here. Yeah, I see them.
Good. Yeah. So, you know, he makes film deals. I'm not sure exactly how much money in theory he still owes. Like, you know, that was part of the deal, was he was supposed to pay it back, and he's never going to pay it back. So I'm not sure how much money he can actually have, you know, without handing it over to the courts to pay back the banks. But, you know, in a lot of ways, you know, he's a bit diminished physically. He's not, you know, he's older and, you know, balder, but he's still kind of himself. You know, it's, We went to a Kings game with him, and you know, they welcomed him like a, you know, people shook his hand, and we were, you know, there was a big alumni thing on the go and a private box, and all those guys, players loved him, right?
Sure, they did.
Yeah, yeah. It reminds me of Garth Drabinski, you know, the theater guy in back east in Toronto, who, you know, all the actors, you know, like his accountants didn't like, his investors really didn't like him because he swindled them, but the actors and musicians, they loved him because he paid them.
Yeah.
Right. You know, he was an enthusiast, so he always paid them really well. And Bruce, if you were a hockey player for the Kings flying around on the private jet, man, that's, you know, that was better than pretty much playing anywhere in the NHL in those days.
Well, and the first signal should have been when he bought the Argos. It's like, what are you doing? A CFL team? Hang on. This guy's not so sharp.
But, you know, he thought he could do the same thing, right? Like, what he saw there was, okay, there's only one football league in North America, one professional football league in North America. These teams don't cost anything. They got a team in the biggest market in the country playing in a dome stadium. You know, what if I brought in, you know, the you know, and again, not the football equivalent of Gretzky, but that, in his mind, that's what it would have been. What if we sold the idea, you know, of a great player, do this? And, you know, look, they didn't care about hockey in L.A., so, you know, they don't care about the Argos in Toronto, but what if we did this? It was exactly the same, you know, it was exactly the same game plan. And, you know, there were guys around the league, Larry Rickman, you know, who was in Calgary. There were a bunch of guys who, you know, it was the same kind of a pyramid scheme, right? If we sell one expansion team for X, then the next one, then my team's worth that, you know, and I can go to the bankers and say, look what teams are worth. And, you know, that led directly to that whole American expansion thing. That's, you know, that's what Bruce was, that was the game. And, you know, if you keep moving forward quickly enough, you know, kind of ahead of your creditors, you know, maybe. Like, I'm not, you know, like, again, I don't think that whole thing was doomed from the start. It was doomed because Bruce almost immediately, you know, like right after that deal for Rocket Ishmael, you know, it's like that was right when the screws started to tighten on him financially. And, you know, he cut off the money to that team the second year because he had a lot of other bills to pay and a lot of other people trying to get money from him. So they became, you know, less of a priority almost immediately, and then that was the end of it. But that was the game. That was the idea there, to do exactly the same thing. Take a superstar athlete, and even if people didn't know, you know, didn't really know the fine points of it, that they would turn out, that you could sell the sizzle. That was exactly what he was trying to do.
Just, I will never be able to pull that kind of stuff off. I don't know how, like, A, I don't know how you do it, and then B, I just don't know how you continue to, like you say, you get money, and then, well, you don't have it to pay off the loan. Well, we'll give you more. It's like, oh, now we're in trouble. Now we'll give you even more money. I don't know how you consciously do that, but boy, he found a way. And hey, there's a lot of people that do it, I guess. Crooks,
well,
right?
How do you sleep? How do you sleep
God,
at night?
I don't know. I don't know.
I've always wondered that. You know, 90, because in, like, in 93, when the Kings went to the final, right, and played the Canadians and, you know, beat the Leafs in the semifinal and all that, like, they were flying around on the private jet and with the movie stars, and Bruce, the big party was moving, you know, and he knew, like, he knew he was going to jail. You know, he knew it was coming down. And I know he says now, well, I always thought maybe this could happen to me. But he's the one guy that knew, you know, maybe a couple of people who worked for him, you know, that, who were helping him to fiddle the books. But none of the other people in the big party on the plane knew. But he knew. And yet, there he was, you know, smiling Bruce, life of the party, pouring the champagne. That takes a certain kind of person. And he is more that kind of person than anyone I've ever met in my life.
Whatever that is.
But yeah. It's true. He's like, he's totally fascinating, you know, to me. And I'll tell you, if he was sitting there with you, you'd like him. He's the most likable guy ever.
Yeah.
You know, like, the difference is, if you take him out for dinner now, you pick up the tab.
Yeah, I suppose. Or yeah, or you're washing dishes.
Yeah, his bankers don't pick up the tab.
Yeah. What else can we... You are a polarizing guy. Things happen. When you do things, people take notice. You go to the Dominican, you do a story on Vladdy Guerrero Jr. The Jays see it, immediately move him to AAA.
Yes.
He's now hitting bombs every single night. Again, your grip on sport is impressive.
Well, thank you. Yeah, so, I mean, it's amazing I can exert that control from such a distance here.
Because I'm guessing Shapiro had no idea that the guy was even in AA until you did your piece.
Do you think so? Yeah, you might be correct. We've nudged him along. We haven't quite got him to the big leagues yet, though. I don't think we're going to this year.
Matter of time.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It is a matter of time. And it's, you know, there's not one thing about him to suggest that the hype is not, you know, you can believe the hype, I believe, with, yeah. You know, with some security. He's what everybody says he is.
What's the hype around him in terms of in Toronto, Stephen? Like, what's the climate around Vladdy Jr. right now?
It's, you know, there's as much attention being paid to him in Buffalo right now, you know, I think, as there is to the big team. It's, you know, understandably, he is the, you know, big part of the future. I think people are restless. You know, it's no fun watching a team play out the string, for the last 3 months of a season, but that's what folks are going to watch. And I assume people are going to get even more impatient or less patient as we inch towards October. So I don't, you know, again, I don't think he'll be a September call-up. He might be. But I think the plan is to send him to the Arizona Fall League this year and get him a few more games there and then shut him down and bring him to spring training. And you can imagine what spring training is going to be like next year.
Yeah.
Like that, it's going to be all Vladdy all the time. And yet, again, I don't think he'll start the season with the team because of the service time issue. So my guess is he will be sent down and come back 3 weeks into April, the first week in May, or whatever it is, with to protect that extra year of service of control for the franchise. So, yeah, we're going to be talking about him a whole lot, and we'll probably be talking about him, you know, him and a not competitive team next year. Again, if things fall into place, you never know. But I don't remember, aside from the really early years of the Jays, like way, way back when you first had, you know, guys starting to come through this, you know, from their system, and, you know, the Mosbys and Barfields coming through, and then, you know, George Bella guy they acquired, and Dave Steeb, you know, the first flickerings. But the Jays have never really gone through this. You know, they've never really had they've tried to reload, and you know, they've spent more money or spent less money, but we haven't seen, you know, a super prospect plus a bunch of other really, really good ones. You know, right now, like, I think Baseball America ranked them the third best farm system in baseball. Now, you know, there's reasons for that, you know, and one of the biggest reasons, if you have the best prospect in baseball at the top of it, you're going to get rated. But we're going to see a wave of young players here. Like I say, most Jays fans, you know, memories wouldn't go back far enough to remember when the team was really, really young.
Is John Gibbons, because I'm just reading notes, like, again, we have a sister station, a little station, 590 in Toronto, yeah, that we keep an eye on. Is there danger of John Gibbons leaving? Is it imminent, or what's the situation there with him?
I would not be surprised if he's gone before the season's over, that they don't wait to the end of the season. You know, there's a certain, obviously, look, there's a certain sense of inevitability here. You know, he's not going to be the manager in 2019. And that's, I think he knows that, and I think everybody around the team knows that, so it's not a big shocker. But I guess the question would be, you know, is there any value in making that move before the end of the season? You know, if you see, I think they would do it. And again, I kind of think they will do that, but, you know, I don't know for sure. But I kind of anticipate that. I think the problem is you don't want to, you know, especially when you got a bunch of young players around, you don't want to see kind of bad culture creeping in. You know, you don't want to see a situation where something really creeps in among, the younger players, that when it gets sour, when the veteran guys who know it's over stop trying, when guys stop running out ground balls. You don't want that to kind of infect the clubhouse. And I think that would be the worry.
So what's up for the weekend?
There's a little bit of music and stuff going on. I got probably my last salmon of the season yesterday, and then off we go to the Writers at Woody Point starts next Tuesday.
That's
so
great.
We have a big party at the house here on Monday night, out in the backyard, and then things get very lively for the rest of the week.
Very nice. I notice you've already kind of cleared your schedule for next week, so that's good.
Well, not going to come. I'll be here Tuesday.
Uh-huh.
But Friday is probably best I'm not on Friday morning.
Well, we'll allow that. That's fine.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, we'll permit that. Hey, have a great time, all right?
All right, thanks. We'll do.
Stephen Brown.